Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
An inalienable right to broadband.
We know we can't build our economic future on the transportation and information networks of the past. We are remaking the American landscape with the largest new investment in our nation's infrastructure since Eisenhower built an interstate highway system in the 1950s.
There's a wide open road, it's leading south from my abode.
In many places, the American information landscape hasn't gotten much beyond a pickup truck, a phone booth, and a gas station. Can the federal government's stimulus billions bring future to the present? How much cash will it take? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Tuesday, March 16th, and The Takeaway is broadband for all. Is it a right or just a jobs program?
And are there people who have the right to stay unconnected in the world?
Turn it off if you like. Yes,
let's get right to the top stories. Democrats have begun their climactic push to move health care legislation through the House by the end of the week. President Obama tells ABC News he wants to see a vote this week.
This is not a problem I chose. This is a problem that is there. We've got to start now. If we don't start now, it's going to be too late.
This week's vote in the House is to approve the Senate's bill along with a package of fixes to change things that House Democrats don't like, such as a tax on high-value insurance plans. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says,
when we bring the bill to the floor, we will have the votes.
Democratic hope to hammer out final legislative language and get a cost estimate from the Congressional Budget Office today.
Dozens of officials from the FBI, the DEA, and other U.S. agencies have joined an investigation into the killings of three people tied to the U.S. Embassy in the Mexican city of Juarez. Earlier, we spoke to Sarah Yana of the Christian Science Monitor, who's just been in Juarez. She says everyone has a story about extortion from the drug gangs. One small business owner she spoke to was visited by gang members just before Christmas.
And then they showed up in December, basically with a gun, and said, listen, you have three options. You either pay, your place gets burned down, or you're dead.
Mexican President Felipe Calderon is expected to visit Juarez later today. The FCC will unveil an ambitious plan today to bring high-speed internet service to millions of Americans who currently can't get it. It would also lower prices for 200 million current subscribers. We're joined now by Jed Kolko, an expert on technology policy at the Public Policy Institute of California. Good morning, Jed.
Good morning.
Is this a broadband for all policy coming out of the FCC? And if so, how much would it cost?
We're already moving in the direction of broadband for all. This plan would cost something in the range of $20 billion or a little bit more, with some plans for already how it might be funded.
Now, you can actually save a bank for something like that. Jed Kolko, we'll talk about the details of the FCC plan. Also, speak with a former FCC commissioner in just a minute.
In Afghanistan, we're learning this morning that the Afghan government was holding secret talks with the Taliban's number two, Mullah Bardar, when he was captured in Pakistan. Meanwhile, our partner, the New York Times, says General Stanley McChrystal, the top NATO commander in the country, has brought most of the special forces operations under his direct control for the first time. He says that should help reduce civilian casualties.
Rock and roll royalty. Well, you decide. Asking the immortal question at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, does Genesis belong there? Reggae singer Jimmy Cliff apparently does. The Stooges, the Hollies, and the Swedish band ABBA were all inducted last night. Asian markets are down. European indices are up. Futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 10,642. The S&P opens at 1,150. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,362. Is the music industry in its death throes? Any South by Southwest attendee would emphatically tell you no. Coming up, Jack Grace checks in from the epicenter, Austin, Texas, South by Southwest.
When I was growing up, my parents gave me lots of advice about finances. But for these times, maybe my grandparents' advice from the Depression was more apt. Do you have tips? Did you learn tips from your parents or grandparents? Give it to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. We're going to learn more about this first-ever national broadband plan in just a moment.
Well, Well, let's get right to it. Celeste, you know, 50 years from today, we could look back on this day and say it was a huge moment in American history, or we could forget that it
ever
happened.
Or I'll be 90, so I would probably have forgotten everything.
That's right. But seriously, the potential is there. The Federal Communications Commission is unveiling today its first national broadband plan. It was promised when President Obama signed the stimulus package earlier this year. The idea: brings super-fast internet access to, internet access to every corner of the country. They've been ruminating over what this would actually mean at the FCC for more than a year now. 100 million Americans currently don't have access to broadband. Would that change under this proposal? We have two people to talk about it. Reed Hunt was the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission from 1993 to 1997. He's currently CEO of the nonprofit Coalition for Green Capital. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Good morning, Reed Hunt.
Good morning.
And Jed Kolko remains with us. He's the Associate Director of Research at the Public Policy Institute of California. Jed, good morning once again.
Good morning.
So you said this would cost $20 billion. Would this actually constitute a broadband for all? And do you think broadband is a right in the sense that a dial tone is essentially a kind of right, or at least was during the 70s and 80s in the United States?
The plan has its very ambitious goal: broadband availability for essentially all households in the U.S., with very high-speed access for most of those households. Now, we've already been moving in that direction by the market itself and by last year's broadband stimulus. What this plan does is it pushes that goal to a higher level, as well as set some specific recommendations for applications around broadband, like healthcare, education, and public safety.
All right, Reed Hunt, how would the regulatory scheme for something like this differ from what has traditionally been the role of the FCC, which licensed analog broadcast frequencies for traditional broadcasts, radio and television? What would the FCC need to do to control wireless broadband, which is, number one, digital? It's not sort of single-source transmission like television broadcasts. So give me a sense of the differences here.
Well, the Federal Communications Commission has been trying to make broadband the common medium of the United States basically since approximately 1994, when the Internet was first deployed widely as a commercial phenomenon. We happen to be this week celebrating the 25th anniversary of the first .com, the first website, but the deployment of the Internet it originally occurred, of course, because people were able to connect telephone lines to the back of computers without any charge. That's because the FCC said that the telephone companies weren't able to charge you for doing that. That's called narrowband, and that's the way that about two-thirds of all Americans connected to the Internet from 1994 all the way through to the early 2000s, and still a third of everybody who connects to the Internet uses a telephone line.
But you need a totally different
son of narrowband.
But you need a totally different regulatory scheme if you're not using telephone wires anymore.
No, you don't need a totally different regulatory scheme. You need to much more expansively pursue the path that the FCC has been traveling for the last 15 years. The significance of this plan is that it is the first national comprehensive communications and media plan in the history of our country.
All right, let me get an assessment from Jed Kolko then. If that is the case, and if it is ambitious, as former FCC Chairman Reed Hunt says, what is the danger that this would just become a subsidy for some very profitable companies that are already internet broadband suppliers and would be getting this $20 billion to add more wires, add more capacity?
The plan works both by a mix of regulations and incentives and subsidies, both for providers to expand their networks out to some underserved areas, and subsidies to households, similar to what we've had that subsidized households for the telephone service. The plan is actually designed to leverage a relatively small amount of money compared with what's likely needed from the private sector to make these investments in broadband, bringing very high-speed access to underserved areas. Is expensive to do. There were some who were actually hoping that the plan might have suggested much more federal money than is actually likely to come from it. And so I actually think of the plan as a fairly modest amount of money relative to what the ambitious goals are.
Mm-hmm. Reed Hunt, wouldn't it be more equitable to create a system where broadband was essentially free in the way that broadcast signals were available free to people? Wouldn't that deal with the digital divide problems we have in the United States, both for rich and poor and for rural? Go ahead.
Advertising had to pay for broadcasting, and there always has to be something that pays for the construction of any communications medium.
But in this particular case, poor people are going to have a harder time getting access than people who have the cash.
If you mean that it's easier to buy something if you have more money, I guess everybody in the world knows that particular experience. But the important thing here is to recognize that...
That's a fairly cynical dismissal.
The important thing here is to recognize that this plan is the cheapest jobs bill that you could possibly imagine. The plan is overwhelmingly funded by the companies in the communications media sector, and... For example, the kind of incentive they're going to be given under this plan is the opportunity to have twice as much wireless spectrum available for commercial development as currently exists. This is basically the same as an Oklahoma land rush for spectrum and will invite tremendous investment in.
Indeed.
It's worth just remembering that about one quarter of the 21 million new jobs created in the 1990s came from the information communications sector, directly or indirectly, and this plan contemplates that a similar kind of job growth will well up from the new technological platforms that are
Indeed.
Rolled out that are called broadband.
Reed Hunt, chairman of the Federal Communications Commission from 93 to 1997. Jed Kolko, before we go, the analog broadcast spectrum is up for grabs in this bill, and the television networks aren't happy about it. What might analog broadcast be used for in this new internet age? Before we go.
So the couple of potential political controversies that arise from this are, first, the possible shift of spectrum from broadcast television to internet. The other is the possible shift of money that supports low-income household use of telephone service to broadband service.
And I could have my own TV station even. That's possible here. Low power anyway. Jed Kolko, Associate Director of Research at the Public Policy Institute of California, contemplating broadband for all if the FCC plan is as ambitious as they say. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some other stories we're following at this hour.
It would be the largest overhaul of financial regulations since the New Deal. That's what Senator Chris Dodd is saying anyway about his financial overhaul bill.
We must protect American consumers and honest businesses so that they can and we can restore optimism in our economy and confidence in our institutions, renew the flow of credit and capital, reestablish America as a world leader and financial services.
The bill was unveiled yesterday. It would give the government new powers to break up companies that threaten the economy. In Haiti now, where Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is pledging continued U.S. support in the reconstruction effort.
Haiti will be a priority so long as I am Secretary of State, and I know it will be one for all of you who have helped in the largest, most difficult humanitarian rescue and recovery effort we've ever attempted.
A reconstruction conference takes place today in the neighboring Dominican Republic.
The heavy rain and wind that pounded parts of the Northeast for the past 3 days is finally moving out, but cleanup from the storm isn't over yet. A photo on the front page of our partner, the New York Times, this morning shows Little Falls, New Jersey, under several feet of water. Finally, a little story we found for you this morning. The government in South Korea is to offer special software for people who are, quote, addicted to the internet. It will limit the time they spend online. Another application makes video games progressively harder so the player actually gets bored. You think that'll work?
No.
No, yes.
Honestly,
and
I just
you
think
know.
It'll make them more
you
addicted.
Know.
That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, the story of a very unlikely high school varsity football coach in Washington, D.C., a woman. And Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen will be here to tell us about her and why that is unlikely.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our first takeout is in the domain of sports, but it runs much wider than that. It's a story about gender, and it's also an interesting story about the coming of age for young men in high schools around the United States. On Friday, maybe you missed this, Coolidge High School's football team in Washington, D.C. got a new head coach. Natalie Randolph was hired as the head coach at Coolidge High School and is believed to be the only female in the United States to be coaching a high school varsity football team. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is here with us. First of all, I was surprised that this is a first.
I was actually surprised that this is the first time that's ever happened.
Well, one of the reasons that it's so rare is that one of the prerequisites for being a coach is actually having been a player.
Right.
So you understand the game, the nuance of the game, and there's not that many opportunities for women to play the game of football.
So what do you think of this decision?
Well, I mean, my initial thought was like, this is good and this is a move forward. And another thought was that with the amount of young men in urban areas that are growing up without fathers and father figures, the primary authority figure in their lives are women, their mothers, their aunts, their grandmothers. So from that perspective, I think this makes sense because you have a woman in an authority role. I think she'll be able to communicate with them in that sense.
So from the environment of Washington, D.C., as far as you're aware of it, this woman could have credibility that she might not have in other places around the United States.
Well, it's important that she actually has played football before. So she was a wide receiver in a women's football league. So she has that credibility. She was an athlete in college. She was a sprinter in college. She understands the culture of athletics. And then she also was an assistant at the same school. So she's got a resume that says, okay, I can do this.
She knows the program.
Precisely. So yeah. that helps her out. And her relationship with the players seems like it's going to be fine. I think the challenge for her is going to be a relationship with the coaches and credibility with parents as well.
You know, what do young people who play high school varsity ball face? I mean, in a sense, it's tough on your body. It's an enormous time commitment, and there are enormous sort of risks in terms of your academic achievement as well. But there are enormous temptations if you actually are good enough to make it in the college game.
The core of what the value of a high school sports program is that it's a youth development program. Take away all the competition and all these different things about it. It's at the core, it is a youth development program. So her challenge is going to be, can she translate the lessons of real life and that come up on the football field? Can she translate how those lessons connect to the football field and to real life and help them to grow as human beings and as men?
What did your coach tell you in high school that helped you when you went away to Rhode Island, right?
So the last game that I played in high school, my junior year, we lost the state semifinal game to go to states, and we're crying. It's like a really tough moment, and our coach brought us together, and he said that in your grown-up life, you will face challenges much worse than this moment, and you will remember this moment almost as a joke because of what you'll face in the real world. And I remember thinking, wow, he didn't say anything about how we played. That was the first thing he said to us. And Coach Jack Berger from Troy, New York, was one of the most amazing coaches ever.
I got to give him a shout out. A little twinkle in the eye there. You see that? So Natalie Randolph, hired as head coach of Coolidge High School, you know, ought to be able to deliver those kinds of lessons. But let's get down to the sort of football details. She was a wide receiver when she played, right?
Yep.
Are wide receivers good coaches?
That's a funny question.
Or is it more the quarterback, or is it more maybe someone in the defensive side?
I think for the position that you want for a coach, that's an interesting point. A lineman is generally a good coach because they understand the grit of the game.
Right.
And so that's
the big picture.
Precisely. And so my that part of it, I think, I will wonder, will she be able to understand what those linemen are going to have to deal with?
Wide receivers have got a little ego issue, right? Don't they, maybe a little bit?
The wide receivers see things from this other perspective outside of, they see the edges of things.
Right.
So I don't know if they get into the muck and the grime of the game. So that's where, you know, the real grittiness of football, I'm not sure if she's going to get that.
And, you know, what's Coolidge's record? I mean, are they a power team? Are they someone where there's a lot riding on this, kind of like Notre Dame?
They're a mediocre team from their record, but also their school has been taken over by a private firm outside of D.C. So I think there's a lot of issues here that kind of collide. This is an experiment, and I think it's going to work well. I think she has the temperament to do it. She's almost like a Jackie Robinson temperament.
Yeah.
She's going to, from all accounts, she's going to face the challenge and face it well. And I think maybe this will open a door for other people to see that women can coach at this level.
I think we should send Ibrahim down there to report on that.
Absolutely.
I would love to go meet her.
All right, we will do that. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports Contributor. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And for our last takeout, we go to our listeners. We want you to check in on the news and stories with us. And one of the things that still has you talking is our question to you of what do you think Haiti needs from the world right now?
What Haiti needs right now is jobs.
To develop strict building codes.
We are just pouring good money after bad.
The primary need is truly shelter.
Only one thing Haiti needs
is health and corruption in Haiti.
We also got some great responses up on our website. You can weigh in with other people. That's at thetakeaway.org.
We're getting more stories from you as we track the census. We talked yesterday about how some cities are actually shrinking and asked for stories from you on why your town might be one of those shrinking cities. Tina posted to our site, I've lived in Hollywood, Florida since 1957. Now, a lot of the empty houses I see are a testament to the fact that we're unable to afford living here. In the not-distant future, only the wealthy will be able to live here, and the future is very close. Just about everyone I speak to agrees and are looking for a way to get out. Cost of living here and owning property is becoming unsustainable. Peter writes to us on our Facebook page, keep an eye on Miami. Things are going to get bad fiscally, and I predict an exodus as city services go to crap and businesses close under new city fees. Doesn't sound like things are great in Florida for them, but what about your city? Keep your stories coming because we want to track what your hometown is like, maybe even come back to you as we talk more about the census. Make our own census map here at The Takeaway. That's at 877-8-MY-TAKE or on our site, thetakeaway.org.
Another thing that we want from you is your slogan, six words or less. Give us anything, a six-word phrase on anything from politics, culture, your life, your dog. Beginning April 12th, you can vote for your favorite at our website, and if you're one of the top five winners, we will make your T-shirt with your slogan on it. Here's some samples of what we've already gotten.
It's still better than John McCain.
We also got fund social political programs, area. Tax all tweets. And then we have WWJD, what would Jeter do? And Ibrahim can
Ibrahim
appreciate.
Loves that one, yeah.
Fewer carbs, the change we need, KNEAD, ooh. And totally connected with nothing to say. Give us yours at thetakeaway.org. So Nancy Pelosi says they will bring the health care reform bill to the House floor as soon as they have all the votes. Well, the man in charge of getting those votes is James Clyburn. He's going to talk to us in just a moment about how he's getting those votes collected. First, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. Millions of people in Southern California were shaken awake by an earthquake this morning, about a half an hour ago. The magnitude 4.4 quake was centered about 10 miles east of downtown Los Angeles. It happened just after 4 a.m. Pacific time. No immediate reports of serious damage, but it did jolt people out of bed. Dozens of officials from the FBI, the DEA, and other U.S. agencies have joined an investigation into the killings of three people tied to the U.S. embassy in the Mexican city of Juarez. Earlier, we spoke to Jessica Pena, a sociology professor in Juarez. She says her family has been forced to change the way they live in order to avoid the violence in the city.
We do have to make, you know, a little bit of adjustments, like when dropping them to school or picking them up from school. We do have to be careful.
Mexican President Felipe Calderon is expected to visit Juarez today.
Further signs of strained relations between the U.S. and Israel this morning. Special U.S. Envoy George Mitchell is putting off a planned visit to the region. Israel angered the U.S. by announcing it would build apartments in disputed East Jerusalem during a visit by Vice President Joe Biden last week. Here in the Northeast, the governors of Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Connecticut have all declared a state of emergency because of flooding. The states have been battered by storms the past few days that have toppled trees, flooded roads, and left at least 9 people dead. This man just outside Boston told CNN this morning he saw a woman barely escape being trapped underwater in her car.
Saw water coming in. She had power to get the window down. She had to climb out the window, grabbed her keys and her cell phone. Climbed out the window, called 911, and had a swim.
Rivers in the region are not expected to recede until the end of the week. Millions used social networks like Facebook, MySpace, and Twitter, and now so do the feds. More law enforcement agents are going undercover to communicate with suspects and gather information using social networking sites. That's according to an internal Justice Department document. So let's check the markets. Asian markets are down this morning. European indices are up right now. Futures are up, so Wall Street will get underway positively at 10,642, we believe. The S&P opens at 1,150, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,362. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
President Obama is stumping hard for health care.
So look, Ohio, that's the proposal. And I believe Congress owes the American people a final up or down vote.
Well, the president has said he's going to sit down and meet with many members of Congress face to face. And there's one other guy who's going to be doing that to try and get their votes. And that's House Majority Whip James Cantor of South Carolina. It's his job to actually count the yeas and nays for the Democratic Party. And he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Jim Clyburn.
Sorry about that. We have this misprint in our script about there. Sorry about that.
A lot of whips there, Congressman Clyburn. Sorry about that.
Mixing you up with Eric Cantor, who's the minority whip. But we're not going to mix you up today. On Sunday, you were on Meet the Press. You said you did not have the votes to pass health care reform. So 2 days later, are you a little closer to that magic number?
Yes, we are. But we aren't there yet. And I think that there are a few things that we have to be careful of and wait to see happen, and so we can be clear with our members as to exactly what it is they're voting for. We still have not gotten final numbers from CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, to let us know exactly what the thing is going to cost and what the savings are. And until we get all of that, we will not ask those undecided members to give us hard commitments, and so we're waiting on that.
Okay, but there's not all of the people who are holding out on their votes because of cost of the bill. There are those who have other issues with it. Can you give me a rundown kind of those who are maybe standing off to the sidelines, not giving you a yes vote yet? What are their complaints with the bill?
Well, there are a couple of people on our side of the Capitol who feel that they can't go with anything except a single-payer plan. Others feel that the public option ought to be in there, which is something a little bit short of a single-payer. There are other people who wonder whether or not the abortion language is to their satisfaction. There are a plethora of things that people are concerned about, and it all depends on what region of the country they're from, as to whether or not they think the regional disparities that have been adequately dealt with. So there are a lot of things here that we have to get people comfortable with, and we're still working.
Okay, so since you're speaking about regional concerns, let me play you this clip, Representative Clyburn, of President Obama, when he's talking about how politics are kind of getting in the way.
And now as we get closer to the vote, there's a lot of hand-wringing going on. We hear a lot of people in Washington talking about politics, talking about what this means in November, talking about the poll numbers for Democrats and Republicans.
So he's saying that that's a bad thing, but this is what you deal with every single day. You're dealing with people who are concerned about re-election campaigns in November.
Well, that's quite true. Those are individual cases. But the fact of the matter is our caucus really feel that the American people ought to have universal access to health care. Now, that is a very strong feeling in our caucus. And there are some of us who believe that that's more important than any individual's reelection. And so working collectively, we are going to try and get the 216 votes that are necessary, because this is something that we have gotten very close to, that's been many administrations have tried for almost 100 years, and we believe that time has now arrived for us to have all of our working men and women covered by health care.
Okay, but that can't be a popular thing. Let me ask you yourself, is your reelection, if your constituents had told you they would not reelect you, if you voted for this health care proposal, would you still back it if you were going to lose your job in Congress?
Well, I think I would. I'm not sure that I would. And it all depends on whether this was my first term or where I am now in my ninth term. A lot of these factors. But I hear from enough people about the individual aspects of this bill to make me certain that nobody wants a child of theirs born with diabetes not to be able to have health insurance. Nobody wants to have their insurance company sending them a letter telling them they're no longer covered as soon as they get a catastrophic illness. I believe that every child that finishes, or a young man or woman finishes college and decides, I want to go to medical school or to dental school or law school, and they're told, if you do so, you won't have insurance, because at 21, you're off your parents' policies, and if you aren't working, you don't have insurance.
Well,
these
mentioned
are things that people want out of their lives, and I think that when you talk to people about this and make it personal to them, You can overcome that.
Congressman, you mentioned the kids in college. A $70 billion college financing bill was added to this bill here, I suspect, in an effort to get progressives to find this vote much more palatable. Do you think it's working based on the kind of work you're doing?
No, sir. That's not why we did it. We did it because the budget resolution a year ago mandated that education and health care had to be a part of reconciliation. And in order to get us to where we need to be on the deficit reductions that come with the reconciliation bill, we had to add the education thing to it, as we mandated a year ago.
Is that gaining you votes or losing you votes, putting them together like that?
Well, I know of one or two votes that have now decided they may not go with us because of it, but I think there may be three or four that decided this is a good for them.
Well, we'll have to see whether you get these votes in time to meet President Obama's deadline. He said he wants it on his desk this week. James Clyburn, get back to work. He's the House Majority Whip and a Democratic congressman from South Carolina, joined us from Washington. Coming up, we're going to take you to the center of new and exciting trends in music, the South by Southwest Festival in Austin. We're going to check in with Jack Grace later this hour.
Pictures can absolutely make a difference. That's what photojournalism is. Strong images of historical events do have an impact on society.
It's the voice there of Charles Moore speaking in 1995 in a documentary called Charles Moore, I Fight With My Camera. We lost Charles Moore this week. He died at the age of 79 at his home near West Palm Beach, Florida. But his pictures did make a difference, and they will live on. Most of them, many of them, are indelible pieces of history that chronicle the civil rights movement in the United States. Joining me now is Hank Klibanoff, a co-author of the book The Race Beat, The Press, The Civil Rights Struggle, and The Awakening of a Nation. Hank, good morning.
Good morning to you.
You know, Charles Moore, you can see it in some of the pictures. You can tell he was the only one there and possibly the only white person who understood what was happening in America at the time he was clicking that shutter. How distinctive a photographer do you think he was?
Well, he was very unusual in that while, like many, he was Southern-born and raised under very Southern influences, he had a real mixture of influences over him, whether it was the loss of his mother when he was a young teenager, or a very open-minded father on issues of race, or his training as a fashion photographer, or generally just his intense interest as a former Marine to be where the action was. And so he always made sure that he got as close to the action as he possibly could.
Partly because he was trained as a boxer.
Well, he was. As a teenager, he had been bullied by some kids, and he didn't like that. And he joined up with Golden Gloves and took some training and fell under the influence of a coach who taught him to always, rather than just watch the feet, as many boxing coaches will teach you to watch the feet of your opponent, he was trained to watch the eyes, and which meant you got to get pretty close. And as a photographer, he insisted always on getting very close so he could see their eyes.
How much of a historical treasure are his photographs, in your view?
Well, when you think about what we would have lost, what we wouldn't have known, what the nation would not have known about the dehumanization of Jim Crow and the power of the struggle without his photographs, it's hard to even imagine the big gap in history that would have existed without Charles's photo.
And you don't have to see the photo to know the image. Dr. Martin Luther King getting arrested and roughed up by Montgomery, Alabama police at that famous rally. Civil rights marchers being attacked by those high-pressure fire hoses. I can see the image in my mind. What did he think of his own significance, Charles Moore?
Well, he was very modest about it. He was a soft-spoken guy, very modest. He didn't start out trying to change the world, but he began to see the influence that he had. He was proud of it in the end. He was proud of the influence that he was able to have. And again, just a very modest, soft-spoken man who had an outsized influence over the nation's thinking on race issues.
And he died at the age of 79 at his home near West Palm Beach, Florida. Thanks to Hank Klibanoff, co-author of the book The Race Beat, The Press, The Civil Rights Struggle, and The Awakening of a Nation, remembering the work of Charles Moore. We'll leave you with his voice once again.
For all journalists covering the civil rights story through the 60s, it was difficult, exhausting, and oftentimes very dangerous. For me, it was all of the above, plus troubling and emotional in a personal way, too, because I'm a Southerner, too.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up...
Way back when they made me one of them. Don't you know they're gonna save my soul?
That's Deer Tick, one of the new bands playing at this year's South by Southwest Festival. We'll take you right there with Jack Grace, Austin, Texas, in just a few minutes. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at coming up to 48 minutes after the hour. In the past hour, Southern Californian residents were shaken awake by an early morning earthquake. The magnitude 4.4 quake was centered about 10 miles east of downtown L.A. There are no immediate reports of serious damage. President Obama says health care overhaul won't be easy, but he tells ABC News, Democrats need to get the ball rolling now.
The question is, if we don't start now, then it won't be in place 3, 4, 5 years from now. And then we'll be waiting another decade or another 15 years or another 20 years to actually take on this problem.
A make-or-break vote on the health care reform bill is coming this week. It's expected to be close.
Overseas now, Middle East envoy George Mitchell has postponed a visit to Israel following tension over Israel's announcement to build nearly 2,000 homes in disputed East Jerusalem. Meanwhile, in the city today, Palestinians are demonstrating as Israeli police have clashed with them after a synagogue was reopened near one of Islam's holiest sites. The BBC diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus has been following the story, and he joins us now. Jonathan, can you tell us how serious are these clashes between the Israeli police and Palestinian demonstrators?
I don't think they're hugely serious in themselves today. Of course, the great fear is that out of a spark like this, some much larger event, something like a repeat or a revival of the Palestinian Intifada or uprising, could emerge. It only takes a small spark to do that. And of course, with no apparent progress on the diplomatic front, the concerns about what else might happen are that much greater.
Well, we're not going to get much progress on the diplomatic front from the U.S. side anyway if our envoy, George Mitchell, is postponing his visit there. Has Israel responded to that?
Well, the Israelis, no. I mean, the Israelis are expected to respond to President Obama's ultimatum, really. He wants them to do a wide number of things, and one assumes one of them is to rescind this decision to go ahead with building in East Jerusalem. Relations between Israel and the United States are at a very, very serious low at the moment. Some people are comparing it to a row back in the mid-1970s with when Henry Kissinger was Secretary of State. Things are at a pretty low ebb, and I think it's clear that the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's efforts to, maneuver between the American administration on one hand and the more conservative elements of his own government, the religious ministers from the religious right and so on the other, is not working out very well. The Israelis have got themselves into a bit of a fix.
Okay, that's Jonathan Marcus, diplomatic correspondent for our partner, the BBC. Back at home, Michelle Obama wants big improvements in food labeling. She's going to speak to some of the country's largest food companies today as part of her anti-obesity campaign. That's some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
And it's a cloudy, rainy day in Austin, Texas. We're playing all the up-and-coming hits from the bands you need to know about. It's the South by Southwest Festival with takeaway music buddy Jack Grace. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm jealous of you. Listen.
The number one biggest game with the kingdom of fame. At the top because they want to be boss. They don't care who they step on.
So, Jack Grace, who are we listening to here?
You are listening to a band from 1970 called Death. And Death was a band that basically is, some people consider, the father of punk music. All three band members, African-American, and they also claim that that was one of the reasons why they did not get into the mainstream.
Now, you chose this band to illustrate that the music industry is alive and well. How does this band illustrate that, and what are you seeing down at South by Southwest in Austin?
Well, it's not that, the music industry is totally still happening. It's just that it's kind of poor right now. Maybe it could use a little more money. But this evidence that that South by Southwest is paying attention to its roots, and they can pick out a band like Death and have all these people fascinated by it from of all different age groups, show that people still have a real serious interest in music of all different types.
Now, you're from Brooklyn, New York, and your band, maybe your band isn't down there, but I know you're doing some playing down there. What's the scene like?
My band is playing a bunch of shows down here, actually, and the scene right now is the best way to talk about it is what it was like changing flights in Dallas. When I changed flights in Dallas, there were so many instruments strapped on everybody. It looked like an infantry armed with clarinets and sousaphones and everything.
Oh, that sounds great. And yeah. What did you have? You had your guitar, right?
Yeah, I had my guitar. The wife had the bass. And then I have what's interesting about South by Southwest is there's so many musicians down here that I have a mariachi horn section that I use. And I did not have to fly anybody down because so many different bands had flown my horn people down that they were already all down here. Saved me some money.
All right, let's listen to this band. We actually heard a clip from them a little while ago, but let's hear something a little longer. Deer Tick here.
Mm-hmm.
Baltimore Blues number one. It's from their album War Elephant. What do you like about this band?
I just like that they're real song oriented and they've got a beautiful sense of melody, and I just feel like they're not trying too hard and they sound beautiful.
That's great. A lot of trying too hard bands at South by Southwest, yes?
There's no shortage ever. For sure.
Well, let's listen to this for a second. All right, South by Southwest is a place where you can hear music from all over the world. This is a band called Dengue Fever. Listen to this, and I want to ask you about it. Jack Gray's got to love that Cambodian pop, eh?
Yeah, we don't get enough Cambodian pop in the States, and that's a great example of some.
Do you like this band?
I do like the band, but I do find that if you go through their whole repertoire, they start sounding kind of similar when you hear a lot of it. But a little goes a long way, but I enjoy it.
All right, let's get back to your particular situation. Do you expect to get a record deal down there? Do you expect to make money, or do you expect to just have fun? And how many of your band members could you afford to fly down this time?
My wife is on base. That's who I flew down. The rest of the people, because there's so many different people, as I had said, I also have the honor of having Johnny Cash's piano players playing with me, who's based down in Austin.
Oh,
there's
nice.
So many unbelievable roots players down here
and
that
you can
use.
And you can just sort of get together and start a band right there at the festival. A lot of people do that.
There's no problem with being able. You could if you know people, you can pull together any sort of lineup you want right now. You mean if you want a string section, you got it.
All right, let's try a change of place here. Listen to this. Justin Townes Earl playing Halfway to Jackson from the album Midnight at the Movies. What do you like about this?
Well, this is an interesting track that we picked because I haven't actually heard this track before, but I really like it because most of the times he's a vocalist. He's Steve Earle's son.
Right.
And he's really an unbelievable songwriter. I mean, he's got the talent, but even shows me right there in that example that the guy's also he can make good instrumental sounding music.
All right, well, how long are you down there for, Jack?
I am down here until Sunday, and I will be seeing many, many a thing. I'm trying to, my head is going to split open when I think about how many things I'm going to try to get in the next few days.
All right, well, bring me back some MP3s. We're going to go out on Freelance Whales. You want to tell me something about them?
Freelance Whales is your classic. That's the kind of band that you discover down in South By. They're not a lot of people know about them. They're a really fun, quirky band, and that's what South By Southwest is all about, is coming down here and discovering things you haven't seen.
And that's why we sent Jack Gray's Friend of the Takeaway to South By Southwest. We go out on Freelance Whales. Thanks, Jack.
Thank you very much. Have a good time. I know I will be.
You can listen back to that conversation and some of the music that we just heard on our website, thetakeaway.org.
I love South by Southwest. The names of the bands are what I love. Freelance Whales. Are there any Freelance Whales left?
I bet there are some Freelance Whales out there. They're highly unemployed at this point, just like everyone else. You can get some advice on our website if you are unemployed during the hard times. Get some advice from Beth Koblenzer's dad. He wrote up his 5 financial tips on how he survived the Great Depression. You can read it on our website and check out her blog by clicking on the blog. But we're looking for your tips, too. What financial advice did you get from your parents or grandparents or others that you know that you still use today? And do you have wisdom for
maybe
us?
Cautionary tales from your parents.
That's right. 877 about finances.
Yeah.
877 my take or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. You also get a preview of our new series with Beth that starts soon, the DIY bailout, bailing yourself out. Give us your story ahead of time by weighing in on thetakeaway.org or calling us at 877 my take.
I could use a bailout. DIY, I don't know about that. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway, DIY.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.